Good morning, KPCW News. Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. On the phone is Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center. Good morning, Cedric.
Good morning. It's good. It's great to talk to you this morning and, of course, to talk to all of our listeners out there. And let me tell you, you know, today is starting off pretty nice out there. We've got some patchy fog and partly cloudy skies. But as we go throughout the rest of the day, we are going to actually introduce a chance of a few of those afternoon pop-up showers and storms. Now, they're going to be isolated in nature, so not everyone is going to see them. So you may see them in the Heber Valley, but you may miss out on some of those showers and storms up towards Park City. But either way, there is a chance in both places this afternoon. In Park City, high temperatures will likely stay in the 80s, which will be very nice. Heber Valley, yeah, we're probably going to time into the lower 90s as we go throughout the afternoon, but still not too bad with those partly cloudy skies. Now, as we go into the weekend, we're going to introduce a better chance of overall scattered showers and storms. Again, not a complete washout, but be aware there's going to be a better chance of showers and storms. I know the timing is terrible because it's coming in during the weekend time frame, so just make sure you have a backup plan, a plan B if you have any of those outside events maybe going on or something like that. Just be aware that there will likely be some showers and storms in the area. That chance will peak, I think, as we go into our Sunday night and Monday across the region. That's going to be the best chance of those scattered showers and storms area-wide, but as we go throughout the weekend, because of the extra clouds and some of the scattered showers and storms, I think temperatures for most areas will stay in the 80s, including Park City may struggle to be in the low 80s. And as you get down towards the Heber Valley, mid to upper 80s are looking more likely. And then as we head into next week, we'll keep a partly cloudy sky around. Those rain chances will start to go down again, but the temperatures don't shoot back up. So we stay with temperatures in the 80s for the most part heading into next week. So there is going to be some good news there as we go throughout that time frame. The second thing that's going to be good for us, because we're going to have this chance of rain and that southeasterly wind flow, that's going to help push or shove that smoke, at least the thick smoke, off to the north back into portions of southern Idaho. So that means that our air quality will get a little better, and that means our picturesque views as you're climbing up into the mountains to take a look around should get a little better and more clear. So that's going to be a good part of that as well. But again, if you do have some of those outside plans, just know that there is... But whenever we see that, that could lead to some flash flooding if you're going to do like a hike or something like that. So there will be something to keep an eye on. But overall, looking at your weather pattern, it's going to be turning a little cooler. We've got some better rain chances. That's all good news for both the air quality, the fire threat, and also just the fact to keep these temperatures from hitting record levels once again.
Okay, Cedric, thanks. And then it's good news about getting some of that smoke to go away. Have a good weekend.
Yes, you too. Thank you so much.
Coming up, I'll be talking with Tracy Sostrom. She's the new executive director of the Weilerman School of Discovery. Then Daniel Haregi of the U.S. Forest Service will update us on the upcoming closure of the Soapstone Bridge. We then get to hear an interview that Parker Malatesta had a chance to record with local Olympic mountain biker and medal winner Haley Batten. We're going to finish our hour with Amber Conley of the Park City Institute, who has a preview of upcoming concerts. Stay tuned. Let's do a little local news. The upcoming Tour de Suds mountain biking racing is coming up next month, and tickets are still available. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
Tour de Suds is a 7-mile mountain bike race that begins in Park City's City Park and ends at the top of Empire Pass. The ride isn't for everyone, as it's a 2,700-foot vertical climb to the finish line. But that doesn't stop the fun. Participants are encouraged to don festive costumes to celebrate the beginning of the fall mountain bike season. Registration also includes a meal ticket and suds, more commonly known as beer. The nonprofit Mountain Trails Foundation puts on the annual event. Executive Director Laura Anthony says it's not too late to get in on the action.
We're about halfway full. It's going to be a little bit more of a beer garden party at the park this year than it has been in years past. So be extra fun.
Registration is $50 for people 18 and older, $20 for ages 13 to 17, and free for those under 12. More information can be found at kpcw.org. The race on September 7th will kick off at City Park at 10 a.m. E-bikes are not allowed. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Wasatch County leaders say they want to work with their Summit County neighbors to solve a dispute over a road on the county border. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports it's the first joint meeting in years.
West 200 South, a road east of the Jordan Hill Reservoir, crosses the Summit Wasatch County line, and it's been the subject of controversy between the two counties this summer. Camas residents have raised concerns about dust, air pollution, speeding, and noise on the road, which is paved in Wasatch County but unpaved in Summit County. They blame construction in Toohey, a new development in Wasatch County. The Summit County Council said in June it's considering installing a crash gate near the county line to close the road to all but emergency and pedestrian access to the Wasatch County side. Summit County leaders prefer that solution to paving the road, which they say would reduce dust but encourage more speeding. A speed study this spring showed almost 80% of vehicles along the road were speeding. But Wasatch County leaders are concerned the closure would block the main access road for Wakara, another new development along the Jordanelle. So far, the entities haven't agreed on a solution. But now Summit County has invited its neighbor to a joint meeting August 14th, primarily to discuss the road. At a county council meeting Wednesday, Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh told council members the two governments hope to forge a more collaborative relationship going forward.
They also just want to make more regular interlocal meetings with Summit County and to introduce some of the members that are newer on their council. So that's, I think, an explicit intention of this meeting.
Several of the Wasatch County Council members have never met with their Summit County counterparts. Graybaugh estimates it's been about 4 years since the two councils last met. Wednesday's meeting is a work session, meaning no formal decisions will be made. The council members' discussion begins at 6:30 p.m. in the Sheldon Richens Building in Summit County. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
As Summit County looks to potentially regulate short-term rentals, Mountain Town realtors argue outright bans would do more harm than good. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Short-term rentals, or STRs, are defined as rentals for fewer than 30 consecutive days. The market is largely dominated by online marketplaces like Airbnb and Vrbo. According to data compiled by University of Utah researchers last year, 22% of all housing units in Summit County are actively listed as short-term rentals. At a joint meeting of the Park City and Summit County Councils Monday, the Western Mountain Resort Alliance argued STRs are a vital part of the local resort economy. The Alliance is a consortium of real estate groups in high-end mountain towns, including Park City, Aspen, and Jackson Hole. Jack Grecian, a housing policy advisor working for the Alliance, says any short-term rental restrictions may not produce the intended consequences, like more housing for workers.
As an association, we are truly agnostic to the regulation of STRs, but if you start to put the possibilities of regulation on a spectrum, the further you get towards the end where we're looking at either complete bans or caps within communities on regulations, the consequences of those are very extreme.
Based on research from outside communities, Grecian says owners of short-term rentals would likely keep their units or let them sit vacant if such a use was banned. Grecian says a short-term rental restriction could decrease the value of an individual property by as much as $600,000. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Tracy Sjostrom began her position as the new executive director of the Weilerman School of Discovery on July 1, 2024. She joins us in the studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. So, Tracy, can you share a bit about your background and how you came to be at Weilerman?
Sure. I've been in education for 30 years. I graduated from UCLA and thought I was going to embark upon the entertainment industry, but it wasn't meaningful, so I went back to school to be a special ed teacher, and then I went to graduate school to be a school principal. I have been an administrator at all levels, elementary, middle, and high school, and an interim special ed director. I've worked in Park City School District, and I most recently came from Salt Lake City School District, where I was an elementary school principal and a high school principal for Horizonte, an alternative school.
And what is it that attracted you to Weilerman?
I love it. Well, I'm a Park City local. I love the outdoors. I love the community. And you know, after COVID, I felt kind of isolated, like, community needs to be the most important thing. We're wired for connection. So I felt pulled back to working in Park City. And when this Weilerman position became available, I was so excited because it's everything I believe in. Outdoor education, experiential learning, liberal arts, differentiation, and social emotional learning are all my areas of expertise and the areas that I'm passionate in.
I want to talk a little bit more about Weilerman, but first, can you just share with the audience, what is a public charter school? How is that different than the local public schools?
So a public charter school is funded by the government. However, we work independently of a school district. We have a board that helps with decision making, and we, because we don't work under the dark cloud of a large school district, we can make things happen quickly, and we make decisions based on the needs of our students, based on best practices, and using our own creativity to make certain that we instill that passion and love for learning and curiosity in our students. So, for example, I worked in Park City and I worked in Salt Lake, and they have probably 20 to 100 people above us making decisions and providing input, and it gets to be a lot. It can be toxic at times. Park City had 3 superintendents in 3 years, and then Salt Lake City had 5 superintendents in 5 years. So it's easier working at a charter school. We can be simple and do what's most important, which is meeting the needs of our students and help get them on their path to joy and purpose in life.
And what grades do you service, and how many students are currently enrolled in Wildman?
So we service K-8. We also have a preschool program. And currently we have about 450 to 500 students.
Okay. So in a nutshell, when you're talking to parents and prospective students, what do you characterize as special about the mission and approach that Wildman takes?
We have so many things that are special there. The greatest thing is we have our students from K-8, and we really get to know them as individuals and meet their needs. It's such a benefit to work with them year after year for 8 years, because then we know how to tap into their curiosity, and we also know the families well. And it's so important to partner with families in educating kids. We are a safe school. And we're very welcoming and nurturing. A lot of students don't feel safe these days, sadly. There's been OCR complaints in school districts. There's a lot of bullying. I dealt with weapons in schools. We don't have that. We are small enough where we know our kids, we know what is going on, that kids come and they feel safe enough to learn. When you don't feel safe, when your Maslow's hierarchy of needs aren't being met, you can't learn. And kids do feel safe because they know we love them and we're there for them, and we get to know each of them as an individual. Also, we have the experiential learning piece, the outdoor learning. So we are taking advantage of Park City being an absolutely amazing place. We hike weekly. We go out and we learn new skills. We'll go to music studios, fish hatcheries. We go to Moab. We have a huge arts festival. We really tap into what makes learning great. It's not just about reading and writing, but it's about really having meaningful experiences to get you, again, on that path of discovery.
And talk a little bit more about the range of outdoor activities that you take your students into. Is this sort of a fundamental part of the curriculum at all levels?
It is, at all levels. So we are blessed to have a campus in the mountains with trails right behind us, so we get out there and hike regularly. We have opportunities to go skiing, to go snowboarding. We have cross-curricular lessons, so students can learn about science, history, math, and literacy through these activities. For example, going down to Moab or going and exploring different museums. We connect that all with the curriculum so students understand why they're learning what they're learning.
So how do you support students who need social well-being or mental health interventions?
So we use multi-tiered systems of support. So for our tier one, which is for the whole student population, we have social emotional learning curriculum where we focus on character ed. We have a specific trait that we work on every month that we model and that we practice, and we celebrate when students demonstrate that trait. If students need extra support, we have small groups. We have a social worker in-house that implements those small groups, And then they would also do one-on-one if they need even more support. We work very closely with Summit County and other outside agencies to connect our students and families to the resources they need. And Summit County is going to be bringing in some of their social workers into our building to help our students if necessary.
And what kind of class sizes do you have, and how do they compare to the public schools?
Our class sizes are smaller than public schools, so they range usually around 20 students at the most. We really, again, are able to differentiate because we have those smaller class sizes, which is so important to be able to differentiate both for academics and for social emotional learning.
And what geographic areas are students eligible to try to attend Wileman, and how does the enrollment process work?
Anyone can attend Wileman. It doesn't matter where you live. We're choice, we're a charter school. The enrollment process is you put your name in the lottery, and typically you are admitted unless it's a really big class, but typically we're able to accommodate everyone. We want to. We want to serve that need for students that want that outdoor learning and that safe space. So we have students from Salt Lake City School District, Granite District, Park City, Wasatch, South Summit. We have students from districts all over the place.
Okay. And your basic funding comes from this, from the state?
Correct.
And do you also have to do supplemental fundraising
on
top of that?
We do, absolutely. So we don't get as much money as the public schools do, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I hope that changes. But in the meantime, we do have an annual fund. We have a outstanding PTO that does a lot of fundraising. We have a gala, which will be in the fall. For our fundraising, we have, an arts festival, and where we auction off student work, and their work is incredible. And then we ask for donations for activities. So, yeah, we do. And we also write grants.
Now, how does the calendar work in terms of enrollment? When would students have applied?
They can apply right now.
I was going to say, is enrollment still open?
Enrollment's still open. Yeah, and we are evolving with the times. We look to see what the needs are of the community. One thing we're considering right now is the Olympics are coming, and we have a lot of potential Olympians in Park City. So I've been over to the Winter Sports School to talk to them about their program and perhaps partnering with them. So down the road, maybe we could start some of our students on their schedule if they need to start training for the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. And of course, then you'd have to have teachers who are working on that schedule.
We will.
It sounds pretty complicated, but it's pretty interesting that you're looking at that already.
We're looking at that. We're excited, and we know we have a very gifted community.
Last question before we go. You've been there a little over a month?
Correct.
What's been the most surprising thing you found at Wileman?
I am surprised by the community, how awesome they are. The PTO is blowing my mind. I mean, we have such smart, talented men and women that want to help and that are so involved with the school. Having come from Salt Lake District, where I worked at a Title I school, we didn't have as much involvement, unfortunately. And now I just am looking forward to tapping into the strengths of all the individuals in our community to make Wileman a truly great place for students.
Tracy, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this. Daniel Hagri is the Heber Camas District Ranger with the U.S. Forest Service. He joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, Dan. Dano, is it?
Dano, yes. Morning.
Good morning, Dano. Thanks for joining us. All right, Dano, the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest, I understand it's going to close the Soapstone Bridge. Where is the Soapstone Bridge, and why is it being closed?
So the Soapstone Bridge is along the Mirror Lake Highway, about 14 miles east of Cabas. And the bridge accesses the Soapstone Basin area. And the bridge was built in, I believe, in the 50s, or is at least 50 years old, modified a little bit in the 80s, and it has reached its lifespan, really. It's been inventoried by a private third-party contractor, really, is what we do. And that one there has just been degrading over time, and so now is the time to replace it. And it's going to be a significantly better, bigger bridge to access a Soapstone place.
And what does the bridge go over?
The bridge goes over the Provo River.
Okay. And again, tell us a little bit more about, will there be a different design for the new bridge? And you know, what was the basic design of the old bridge? And in addition to sort of upgrade to renewing it, is there a significant design change going on here?
There is a very, very different design. So the bridge, again, was built over 50 years ago. And so that style of bridge is outdated. It has a two-girder system underneath. And so it's really at the point now where the bridge needs to be able to hold more weight coming across there too as well. New vehicles, bigger, heavier equipment, stuff like that. And so it's just reached this time. So this one will have, you know, three girder system underneath. It'll be a longer bridge. It'll be 90 feet total. And it'll actually be two lanes. And it serves, you know, a number of purposes, not only from, you know, public health and safety for you know, the equipment getting across, but the current bridge right now kind of constricts the flow of the water. Mm. And so this bridge now will span that, and we'll start getting less resource impacts from, you know, how small that bridge was built.
And how long is it going to take to build the new, I guess you have to tear down the old bridge before you can build the new bridge.
Correct. They'll start mobilizing on Monday, and then they're looking at probably removing the bridge or beginning to try to remove the bridge on Wednesday. And we're looking at possibly all the way through October for them to complete it. And the reason being is the bridges are built, and there has to be concrete poured, mm-hmm. and the concrete has to be poured in three stages, and the three stages have to be all tested. And so we like to give enough time period in there that stuff can cure and passes all the, you know, all the inspections that we need on there. It could be 30. It could go all the way to end of October, or we could get very lucky and it'd be a little bit shorter. But, you know, we don't promise anything. We always like to make sure that, you know, if Mother Nature throws us a curveball, that mm-hmm. we have enough time to put that bridge in place.
Now, the 12-year-old boy in me hopes you're going to blow it up, but I assume it's going to be a more conventional demolition.
Absolutely. Yes, it'll just be removed and pieced out and then, you know, disposed of somewhere.
Okay, so if this bridge closes, what exactly is that going to mean in terms of access? What are we not going to be able to get to?
So the good thing about Soapstone Basin, which is very popular for recreation, and we're coming on to the hunting season, they can still access from Highway 35 in Wasatch County that way. It's a longer drive, definitely, to come back to our site over here closer to the Provo River. But they still can access from Highway 35 to come over. Again, we ask people to, you know, increase their travel time a little bit and take their time coming down those longer roads. But there is still access over there.
To basically, so everything that you could get to on the other side, you can now just sort of come around. I guess that includes things like the Piuta Camp and Camp Rogers?
Correct. The Camp Rogers, the YMCA camp, the Paiuta, and then even the Soapstone
summer home
area as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any implications with respect to emergency services while the bridge is being closed?
There is. We've been partnered up pretty close with Summit County Search and Rescue Emergency Services as well as Wasatch Counties, and we're looking at multiple opportunities, you know, just how do we address an emergency and at what level? So, you know, we've discussed the helicopter, which is in level one, mm-hmm. Everything all the way down to, you know, even just ATVs, UTVs being stored on the other side over there so we can get access. You know, it is in Wasatch County on the other side of the river, but, you know, the partnership is Summit County has a quicker response time. And so what we're doing right now is we're going to allow the contractor to come in and start looking at what their area of impact is going to be and then work to maybe get a access point across with an emergency service vehicle from Summit County. And that's really what we're going to limit it to on this side.
So, Dana, before we go, can you tell us a little bit about what your regular job is? What is it? What are the job duties of the Heber Camas District Ranger?
Well, that's good. I have a multitude of things. The area, the Heber Camas Ranger District is a little over 500,000 acres. And we've got everything from portions of the High Uintas Wilderness all the way out to Soldier Creek, Blue Ribbon Fisheries. And so we manage everything in there from wildlife, fisheries, timber, fire, fuels, range. I mean, you name it. And that's really what my job is day to day. It's working with industry. It's working with partners. It's working with elected officials and, you know, trying to make sure that in our lands management plan and providing services to the public and making sure that there's something in the future for our, you know, our next generation, you know, that's really what I work towards, is making sure that everybody is moving in the same direction, and then we've got some land here for the next generation coming up.
Okay, Dano, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Hey, great. Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, we'll be right back after this. Park City's Haley Batten won the silver medal in women's cross-country mountain biking at the Paris Games, the best finish by an American in the event in Olympic history. KPCW's Parker Maltesta got the chance to speak with Batten about her performance in an interview he recorded yesterday.
Today I have a very special guest on the phone with me from Paris. I've got Olympic mountain biker Haley Batten, who took home the silver medal just about a week ago. Haley, how's it going?
It's going really well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and you know, just to start, I think I speak for all of our listeners and the greater Park City area when I just say congratulations. You know, what a remarkable achievement, the best finish by any American in the mountain biking event in the Olympics. I'm sure it's been a whirlwind.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Yeah, I so appreciate the support. It's crazy how much love and support I felt from Park City and all the messages and comments. So yeah, it means the world, and it's why I love this sport so much and the community I come from. So yeah, thanks for having me, and I'm excited to share the excitement with everybody.
Yeah, and you know, to start, I kind of wanted to rewind and just, you know, ask you, when you think about this Olympics, you know, when you think about all the preparation that's gone into it, I mean, where does that journey kind of start for you?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's crazy how years and years of preparation and dreaming and developing as an athlete comes down to, you know, just an hour and a half race and, you know, 5 seconds at the finish line where you can soak it all up and be so satisfied with all the hard work. But for sure, like for me, it really all began in Park City, like no joke.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I started racing. That's where I fell in love with the sport. That's where, you know, there were, you know, midweek races and races on the weekends and just an incredible community of mountain biking. And I remember, you know, with White Pine, I would do the Thursday night rides and doing like the group with my dad and just racing up and down the mountains with a group of the shop guys, you know, and it's just, you know, and young riders and all these groups that I was part of and the NICA High School League, you know, it's all that development and years of, you know, mentorship and amazing trail systems and, you know, feeling so free and independent to be able to ride up the most beautiful trails, you know, and just feel right at home there to adventure farther and climb bigger, steeper climbs and do that with friends and family. So just the passion, I think, for the sport was lit there for me in Park City and the people that supported that. And it turned into an Olympic dream. But I think I wouldn't be where I am today without the true love that I have for the sport and what I get to do and the training and the racing that I love so much.
I understand you were kind of going into Paris. You had dealt with some injuries, a concussion and some Achilles issues. Was that something that you were still struggling with leading up to the race, or had you kind of taken control of that going into it?
Yeah. So after, so our qualification period for the Olympics was included the first three World Cups of the year. So two races in Brazil and then one race in the Czech Republic. And I was lucky, or not lucky, but I worked really hard and was able to qualify at those races. And then immediately after that last race in the Czech Republic, which was the third World Cup of the season, we flew to Paris, and there was 2 days of training on the course open to all the athletes. So we, you know, were able to ride the course, check everything out, and, you know, get video, dial in all the lines. And unfortunately, like literally right as I started, you know, it always happens with mountain biking, just a stupid crash, you know. And that happened to me like literally right as we started checking out the course, and I hit my head, and pretty immediately I recognized, you know, concussion symptoms, and mm-hmm. I'd had a pretty bad one last year. So luckily I learned a lot from that. And I'm in a way lucky for that experience, because I think if I hadn't had that happen to me last year, I think I wouldn't be as prepared as I was this year to know how I need to recover, the approach that I need to bring, and how I need to think about the big picture and also just really listen to my body. So I just immediately took 5 days off the bike, and it lined up well with a mid-season break that I needed anyways after, you know, having to peak for qualification for the Olympics, and I won a couple of World Cups, so it, you know, that takes a lot physically to do, and I needed to rest to be able to prepare for the Olympics. So I was lucky in a way. It was almost like it was meant to be, and I needed to rest and I needed to slow down. And unfortunately, you know, an injury made me do that, but I was able to get back to training within 5 days, which was great. And then, yeah, the last World Cup that I was at in Switzerland, it must have been, like June or something. I raced the short track event, which is a 20-minute race that we do before the main cross-country Olympic discipline. So on the Saturday before, and then we race the XCO on Sunday. And during the short track, I had this, I was really wet and I was running, and I totally thought I strained my Achilles. And I decided not to race the cross-country race and skip that World Cup because I knew, you know, if it was strained, that could be really bad. And, you know, the whole focus of that season, of this year, has been the Olympics. So I didn't want to take the risk of making anything worse. And I was able to travel back to the U.S. and I went to the Olympic training facility in Colorado Springs, and I was able to get an ultrasound right away and confirm that it wasn't a strain, and we were able to rehab. So I was able to, you know, get back to riding within a couple of days with that as well. So I was really lucky. I mean, those challenges definitely make you realize how bad you want it when all of a sudden you feel like it's being taken away in a way. You're like, oh no, like if this was a strain, this could take a while. This could mess up my training, you know? And when you get that close to the games, every day really, really counts. Every session, every workout matters to make you your best, you know, for one day. You have to plan that peak really, really perfectly. And it takes a lot of hard work and planning. So yeah, I definitely was getting a little stressed. So I think it definitely boosted me in a way. I think I was lucky that the injuries were well timed, that they made me rest, they made me slow down when it was necessary. I think it's definitely possible to work too hard, you know, and
yeah.
I think it's about working smart as well. And then it also, you know, motivated me in a way. So I was lucky in a lot of ways, and I had a great team behind me to help me prepare for the games. And by the time I got there, I was 100% and my absolute best for race day.
Yeah, it didn't seem to slow you down. How would you describe the course that you all raced on in Paris? I mean, is that pretty similar to what you're normally doing in kind of these international events?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the course in Paris was pretty cool. Like, I think it was a great race course.
Mm-hmm.
And it Olympic cross-country courses almost have a style to them in a way. They're really fast. They allow for close racing dynamics with the field, you know, so you can have exciting battles, you know, and then there are man-made rock gardens and jump features. So it really tests the full package, I think, of a cross-country rider. You know, you have to be really physically fit for those climbs. You have to be tactically savvy because of how fast the race is, and you know, knowing when to sit on the wheels and when to attack. And then you also, you know, have to be really skilled, know your lines, know how you can maybe gain 5 seconds, 10 seconds on some of the descents, which is hard to do. So I loved racing there. And I think it really brought out exciting racing for both the athletes and the spectators. And also just the French love cycling. So the atmosphere, to have a couple, you know, top French mountain bike riders, you know, obviously Pauline rode away with the win. And I think it was such amazing energy, and I had my family and a lot of friends there. So I think I just soaked that whole environment in, and I absolutely loved it. And it was really, really cool to race in Paris for sure.
Yeah, it looked quite incredible on TV. I can't remember exactly when this happened. You'll have to remind me, but can you kind of walk us through, your tire went flat during the race. Can you kind of describe how did that happen? How did it get fixed? Were you freaking out?
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like when an athlete's preparing, you know, for a key race, I think sometimes it's easy to visualize or prepare or hope for, you know, if I get a medal, it has to be the perfect race. Everything has to go smoothly. And I think that's a mistake in a lot of ways. Like, I really visualize and prepare to overcome. You know, anything can happen. No race is perfect. And these mishaps happen, you know, in training, like we just talked about, and also in racing. You know, it's not perfect, and you have to be mentally prepared to overcome and to to make the most of the situation. And I think for my race, like, I knew on that course, like, it was so important to have a good start too. Just the way the course is designed, like, you know, a front group can really get away pretty quickly, and mm-hmm. just the way the climbs are and the single track sections, I knew that was a key part of my tactic, you know, in preparation. And I didn't really do that right. Like, I got a little, you know, mixed up with the riders and my positioning wasn't perfect. So I think immediately from the gun, like, I was racing from behind and I had nothing to lose. And there's also a different mentality in that as well, which I think fueled me in a way. You know, I was racing, you know, one rider at a time, moving forward. I was never moving backwards. And that was pretty cool. And by the time that I caught the chase group, which was maybe, you know, four riders, you know, yeah. maybe five, that was in a big group trying to move up, I was like, oh my gosh, I made it. Like, I'm here. Okay. And then I was able to drop that group and I could see the bronze medal position, like, not far ahead. And I definitely pushed the limits a little bit on the descent. I was going pretty fast. I knew I was riding those sections well, but I came into one of the rock sections just a little bit too fast and I was offline. And I just slammed this rock with my back wheel, and that was for sure my mistake. And that's part of mountain bike racing. You have to ride well every section, every corner, every rock, you know. And that's part of skills preparation. And that was my bad, and it was a mistake. And for sure, like you said, in my head, the first thoughts are, oh, how could I mess this up again? You know, like, I missed my start. I was worried, you know, maybe the front riders would ride away, and I didn't have a shot at a medal. And then, you know, right as I'd worked up to bronze, you know, I'd done a huge effort to get there. I think I was in like 12th position, you know, and I just got into, you know, almost in the medals. And then I felt like I lost it again. But I think, like I said, you can't let those thoughts, I think, get in your head for too long. Like, racing, this stuff happens and it's about overcoming. And I visualized so much and I prepared so much, you know, the details of my mindset, that I was lucky that, you know, that preparation paid off. And my instinct, you know, was that my mind cleared, you know, I was in the moment, in the zone, focusing on how to execute every climb, every corner, every section. So I think pretty quickly, you know, those thoughts came in, that doubt, and then it was like so clear again. I was just in the moment and I was, okay, how can I get to that feed zone as fast as possible? How can I get to Jerome, my mechanic, you know, so he can fix mm-hmm. this? And he just did the fastest wheel change ever. You know, it was insane, like record time. Probably the emotion that we all felt from the Olympics, you know, and he just did it perfectly. And maybe I was back in like sixth or seventh, but again, like, I had nothing to lose at that point. I was like, okay, I'm out of the medals, right? No chance, or maybe there is a chance. So I'm just gonna give it all. And I think I just went as hard as I could for the last few laps. Like, I had nothing to lose. I was all in, you know, because it was a medal or nothing for me. And so I think I just raced with my whole heart, like everything. I tell people that I honestly didn't feel pain. It was like my legs could climb faster and faster. I could just keep digging in. And I think that was just because I just wanted it so bad. And I think that boost of adrenaline of that fast tire, of the flat tire, really like fueled me all the way to the end.
Yeah, I can't. Sounds like quite a high. I mean, what was that? What was going on in your mind when you crossed the finish line and realized you were going to take home a medal?
Yeah, it was really until the finish line. Like, I definitely thought about it when you're racing. You know, you're there, you want it, but you have to not think about it too much. So it wasn't until, like, I crossed the finish line and it actually was real. Like, I actually made it happen, you know, throughout all the chaos and the mistakes and the pressure and the energy of the race. It was insane. And you really, like, you train for years for those, like, 3 seconds when you're at that finish line. I really, like, that's an addictive feeling to have a race where your peak fitness, right? You can just ride and dig in and fight and be in the most exciting battles for, you know, at the Olympic Games. And then to finish and be like, oh wow, I did that. You know, that's really the best. It's the best. It's insane. It's hard to explain really or put into words. But I think it felt so good. It felt so rewarding. And then to share that with my family, my friends, my coach was there. You know, my mechanic worked so hard to get, you know, my bike as light and as dialed, you know, the suspension, everything was just spot on. And so everybody, you know, invests in that one race, you know, for years as much as I do. And yeah, I'm so grateful to all of those people. And I felt all of that emotion and just the energy of it all. And, you know, there's so much focus and intention for so many days to just feel like the weight, not the weight, but just you can feel how freeing it is, you know, to feel like you really were able to execute a magical day.
And Haley, I just kind of had one final question. You know, what message do you have to, you know, maybe some young mountain bikers here in Park City, or I mean, really just across the country, you know, what kind of message do you have for them that see you and see you winning medals, doing this sport, just for them moving forward in their careers?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's been really cool is, you know, it's not just me that's been succeeding at the Olympic Games. You know, Kristen Faulkner just got a gold medal in the road race, women's road race, which has never been done before. And actually in just a few minutes time, the women's track team pursuit team will be racing for gold against, I think, New Zealand. So, you know, females in cycling and just cycling, you know, Team USA in cycling is taking, you know, a whole new level. And we're no longer the underdogs. I think we've been the underdogs for a long time in Europe. And I think we're showing that, you know, there's a pathway to go big, you know, at big championship and Olympic events. And I think, you know, when I think about my pathway, you know, from a young rider in Park City, you know, doing group rides and being part of Young Riders or, you know, high school mountain bike league, and, you know, setting an Olympic goal and actually, you know, coming home with a medal, you know, it's taken a lot of time and it's been really hard, but it's possible. And so I think if, you know, that's what a young athlete wants to do, like, there's a way, you know, and you can. And I think, you know, a key to it all is, I mean, just talking about my race and my development and everything and my injuries, like, it's not easy. It's really, really hard. And the challenges, you know, in just my race alone, the flat tire, the, you know, this whole drama about, you know, a fine in the feed zone, which is both, you know, emotionally and challenging, and also, you know, just, you know, reflective. And then, you know, my concussion or Achilles injury, like, those challenges are what make you great. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the times people getting into sport, they set themselves back by thinking that those setbacks, you know, are getting in their way, or they're affecting their preparation, or they're holding them back from being great or something. But I totally disagree. Like, every challenge, the harder it's been, the better it's made me. And I think that embracing challenge is what makes us special. I always say that, like, if you don't experience something hard, you're okay, you're fine. But if you wanna be great, you have to overcome challenge. And I think it's embracing those challenges and seeing, like, okay, this happened for me, you know, not to me. I can do this. It's what makes you get on the start line at an Olympic race. And I can for sure say that if I look at the start line of that women's cross country race, every one of those riders has gone through some tough times, you know, and they're there because they're stronger, they're better riders, they're better athletes, and they're better people because of all of those challenges. So I guess, yeah, to young riders and to kids in Park City that are getting excited to ride or set big Olympic goals, I think it's all about embracing the challenge and to, yeah, enjoy the ride.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to leave it. I really appreciate you giving us the time to talk about all this.
Yeah, thanks so much. I couldn't be happier to do it. I love talking about what I do, and I'm proud to be from Park City, so thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Haley Batten, who took home the silver medal in the women's mountain biking event at the Paris Olympics.
A former advisor for Operation Underground Railroad is facing multiple felony and misdemeanor charges after he was arrested outside of Heber Monday. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Rad Christian Barrett was stopped by a Wasatch County Sheriff's deputy on US 40 around 1 p.m. Monday on suspicion of driving under the influence. Wasatch County jail records say Barrett was arrested after failing a field sobriety test. Deputies also reported finding almost $9,000 in cash, syringes, and nearly 80 vials of opioids in Barrett's car. He was charged Tuesday in Wasatch County's 4th District Court with distribution of a controlled substance, driving under the influence, possession of drug paraphernalia, and failure to stay in one lane. Utah State Courts records show Barrett is a former senior advisor for Operation Underground Railroad, an anti-sex trafficking organization that has faced lawsuits and investigations over founder Tim Ballard's sexual misconduct. One lawsuit describes Barrett as one of Ballard's favorite henchmen and alleges he threatened a plaintiff over the phone. During his arrest Monday, Barrett said he travels back and forth between Mexico and the United States, leading the deputy to believe he has been distributing the opioids. According to the Wasatch County Jail, 60-year-old Barrett, who is from Mill Creek, Utah, was released from custody Thursday morning. He is scheduled to appear in a Heber courtroom in September. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Amber Connolly is the executive director of the Park City Institute, and I believe she also goes by the title Director of Fun. She is on the phone this morning to update us on upcoming concerts. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning, Roger.
Okay, what do we got coming up, Amber?
Yeah, so we have Nitty Gritty Dirt Band coming in on Saturday night. We have Spoon on Sunday night. We have George Thorogood coming in on Tuesday night. We have a couple of special discounts for Spoon. It's 50% off our lawn tickets. All you have to do is go Spoon 50, so 50% off, 8/11, which is the date. George Thorogood, we're excited to do a shout-out to all of our veterans and our military, active military, $10 tickets. It's GTD, so George Thorogood and the Destroyers, and it's 10, GTD 10. Another exciting thing that we have going on is Allie and AJ are coming into town. If you don't know Allie and AJ, they're the former Disney girls. And we are saying thank you to all of our educators. So it's a 2-for-1 educator discount and $5 student tickets for that show.
Okay, so let's go back a minute. I'm going to get you to repeat all those codes, but I want to talk about each of the shows individually for a minute. Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, unlike so many of these acts that have been around that long, it still has at least two, I think, of the original and key members. Am I right?
More than that, actually. I think there's four. And this is, every band, as we know, goes on these farewell tours. They said this is the farewell tour, so this is it. So if you want to see Nitty Gritty Dirt Band live with some original members, come out to Canyons Village, Park City Mountain.
And for some of our listeners, they may not be all that familiar. And oh, wait, before I do that, the discount, is there a discount for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band?
There is not.
Okay.
Full price.
I just didn't want to miss it. Okay. Now, with respect to Spoon, tell our listeners who may not be familiar with Spoon who they are, what kind of music they play.
Yeah, so they're an indie band. They're an indie Americana rock band, really well known in the indie world. So if you liked Guster last week, so Guster went through Park City, same place. They're in that same genre. It's going to be a great, great night.
Okay, and will they have a backup band, or will it just be them?
Yes, yeah, Spoon is traveling with A Giant Dog. So this is not Clifford. This is the band A... And sorry.
It's still it was right there.
Roger. I know. It's A Giant Dog, and, they have great music as well.
Okay. And again, is there a code for that show?
Yes, there is. So it's Spoon, so just the name of the band, and 50, so 50% off. And then the date, 8/11.
And so that's a discount code that you would enter on the Institute website if I were trying to buy tickets.
Yes. Okay. All of this information, if you're thinking, oh, my gosh, I'll never be able to remember this, this is all on our Facebook page, our Instagram. You can call the box office. It's also on our website.
Okay. And George Thorogood. I think people know who he is. But for those who don't, share a little about him. Go ahead.
Yeah, so he's been around quite a while. He's actually, I love this, he's 75 years old, and he is just going strong. Probably some of the most popular songs that you'll know is, of course, Bad to the Bone. His genre is boogie blues, and he has always been a huge supporter of our military. So, again, a shout-out to our active military and those that have served our country. That code is for $10 tickets is GTD, so George Thorogood and the Destroyer, so GTD, and then it's 10, so GTD 10.
And the good news about that is the George Thorogood is the original George Thorogood.
He is the original. Okay. That is very true.
And the Disney people, Allie and AJ.
So yes. Yeah. So if you have and I know Roger, you and I have daughters that are somewhat in the same age. If you have younger kids that are like in that 21 to 29 year old daughters and sons, you might know them from Disney, the Disney shows. But they are out on tour, and they're stopping by Park City next Friday night. And again, I know a lot of our schools are back in session, but it doesn't matter if you're a Summit County student or you're a Utah University student, we're doing $5 tickets for lawn for Allie and AJ. And all you have to do is just go to our website for those, and there's actually just a different ticket to select.
And all these concerts are being held at the Canyons concert venue, which I have to tell you, the steepness of that slope really makes the views pretty spectacular from the lawn seats.
I love that, we were really, looking at it's a new semi-permanent stage. We have an amazing partnership with CBMA, Park City Mountains, so a big shout out to them. And we're on, we named it right, concerts on the slopes. We're on a downhill slope. But it is really amazing to be there in the evenings.
Okay, we've been talking to Amber Connolly of the Park City Institute. Thanks for spending time with us.
Of course. Thanks, Roger.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. This is Roger Goldman. I want to remind you to tune in tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. for a special edition of the KPCW Film Panel hosted by Rick Bruff and featuring film reviewers Linda Jager and Andrew Buchanan, along with Park City Films' Katie Wang. That's tomorrow morning at 10, only here on KPCW. And then Monday on Mountain Money, we're going to be chatting with authors Naomi Kahn, June Carbone, and Nancy Levitt about their new book, Fair Shake, Women in the Fight to Build a Just Economy. And we'll also be speaking with Zachary Bretz, the creator of the Park City app.